To start. So let me begin. Let me start by just saying who I am. So my name is Sid Redner. I'm from Boston University. I'm a physics professor there. My research interest is statistical mechanics. And the lectures I'm going to be giving you are based on non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. Now, I actually saw the tape. Leo Kadnoff gave some lectures on equilibrium stat mech, I guess, in September. So I saw the tape of the first lecture. So I'm trying to get a sense of what you know and what you don't know. So I think I have a little bit of a sense. And so as I start lecturing, if I am going too fast or I'm being too boring, I really appreciate you stopping me right away and saying, I don't get it, or it's like, this is too boring, we already saw it before. I mean, I'd like to try and be at the right level. The other small point is that in my older years, my ability to do algebra is getting monotonically worse with time. So I do make mistakes, and so please don't be hesitant to stop me and keep me honest. So I guess you got these lecture notes, and so this is based on a book that's almost finished that I'm working on non-equilibrium statistical physics. And in the spirit of mistakes, let me point out that formula 119, which has got three lines in it, there's already a mistake in formula 119. So in the last line, it reads exponential of n 1 plus something, and just cross out the 1, and then the rest of the formula is fine. Okay. So let me begin then, and I want to start with a little story about random walks and diffusion. And so again, let me just ask the audience here, just what do you know about random walks? What? You got to say it louder.
A drunk bird can get lost forever.
Can get lost forever. In three dimensions, you mean? And you know in two dimensions it won't get lost? Do you know about transience and recurrence? Everybody's happy and familiar with that?
No.
Okay. I was hoping not. Okay. Well, anyways, again, I'm just going to start in the spirit of just starting, and then you'll tell me if the level is right or not. So the first thing I want to discuss for you is the diffusion equation. And because all of the mathematics and all of the ideas are the same in one dimension as in higher dimensions, I'm just going to live in one dimension, just for the case of simplicity. So we have a concentration C as a function of x and t. And we like to understand how it evolves in time. And so the diffusion equation says that this concentration evolves in time in the following way. dc by dt is equal to d, d second c by dx squared. And so what I'd like to demonstrate for you now is a way of solving this equation using scaling, and only scaling. And the reason I want to show you the scaling solution is just that it's a type of mindset that appears in statistical mechanics that's not necessarily in any textbook, and it can be really powerful and very useful in understanding, in developing understanding. So the thing is that this is a partial differential equation, and the world's expert in partial differential equations just gave you the previous lecture. And since I'm not as smart as he is, I'm going to show you a lowbrow way of solving this equation and getting the exact solution with only elementary methods. So the thing is that first thing from the perspective of statistical mechanics, dimensional analysis is a really important analysis tool. And so notice that if I take the d, and let me now just put it over here. Let me write 1 over d. And you see that in terms of just power counting, there's a c upstairs in both sides. It's a linear equation. But downstairs, there is an x squared, and there is a dt. So because these appear in the same place, they both appear in the denominator, and this equation has to be dimensionally proper, it suggests already that x squared should scale like dt. So just in the basis of dimensional analysis alone, you should be able to infer this from the form of the equation. So that's very important point number one, x squared scales like dt. Second point is that with this scaling of the characteristic length with time, we can then reduce this partial differential equation into an ordinary differential equation by something known as the scaling hypothesis. So let me just write scaling. And the idea of scaling is to say, well, look, if I look at my random walker at a certain time t, he will spread out over some range. If I look over range 2t, he will spread out over range square root of 2 larger. And if I continue going to longer and longer time scales, the length scale also gets larger. And so it suggests that cxt is not a function of x and t separately, but it's a function of a length divided by a characteristic length that comes from this scaling formula. So I would say, and so I'll write this as equals. Actually, let me write it with a squiggle here, because I'm not going to worry about constants of order 1. So leave some space here, because I'm going to put something here. But let's say it's going to be some function of x divided by square root of dt. Again, from this equation, this is the natural scaling hypothesis. And this is the only dimensionless grouping that exists in the problem. And so we'd like to say that the concentration is not a function of x and t separately, but a function of the length divided by the natural length scale in the problem. That would be the natural scaling hypothesis. Now, the thing is that why did it leave a space in front here? Because as written, this equation is definitely incorrect, because we also know that, let me maybe put over here, we know that the integral over all space cxt dx, well, that better be equal to 1. So if I start with, yeah, question.
Sorry, so what's the reasoning why it should be a function of, why it shouldn't be a function of x and t separately?
Well, because you see that in the equation itself, you know, you see there's a dt and an x that are same dimensions. That's point number 1. And so we have x squared is going like dt. And then the second point is that if you just imagine looking at a snapshot of a random walker, so at a particular time, he maybe moves this far. A little bit later on, he moves further down the road. And so if you rescale the time, then you rescale the length. So there's a natural one-to-one connection between length rescaling and time rescaling. And because of that fact, it shouldn't be a function of x and t separately, but a function of scaled, you know, of the scaled variable. So again, you know, double the time and the length scale has changed. So if I then said, okay, if I change my magnification, it's the same as changing the time. And so the length and the time have to be grouped together this way. And this kind of rescaling we're going to see in the next 2 weeks over and over again. So if you're a little uncomfortable here, you're going to get bashed over the head many times before the 2 weeks are up. Anyways, the point is that we know this fact. If we start with, a random walker somewhere in space, he doesn't disappear. And so the total concentration has to stay equal to 1. But what that means is that if I now write it in the scaling formulation, I must have here a 1 over root dt. And you can see then that if I calculate the integral of cxt, so let's now write it in the scaling form. This is the same as 1 over root dt f of x over root dt dx. And you see that if I combine this 1 over root dt with this dx and call this new variable, say, dz, then this is just the integral of f of z dz. And you see there's no dimensions anywhere in this thing. So this is a number of order 1. And this is why you have to have this prefactor 1 over root dt to make sure this is properly normalized. So with no real work, we have basically the right functional form of the concentration profile. So the next part of this game here is now I'm going to use this to convert the partial differential equation into an ordinary differential equation. And it's so simple and ordinary that we can solve it with no fancy Fourier transforms or Green's functions or anything like that. So I have a fetish with chalk dust. I hate it. So, oi, 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 oi. Okay. Oh, well, that didn't work very well. Oh, this one, the sponge. Okay, thank you. Okay. Well, it's just scaling out. You know, the probability distribution is just smearing out a little bit. Anyways, okay, so what I'm going to do now is let's take the scaling ansatz and just plug it into this differential equation. Let's see what happens. So let's compute dc by dt. So when we write, if we make this ansatz and plug this in, so there's going to be two terms when I differentiate with respect to time. One where I differentiate the dt. Because it's 1 over root dt down here, I have to differentiate square root of t, 1 over square root of t. And what I'm going to get, let me just write out the answer, and you'll see it's obviously correct, 1 over root dt times f. So when I differentiate the square root of t here, I bring down a minus 1 half t to the 3 halves. I pull out a factor t, and I just have the same root dt in front. Oh, thank you so much. Wow. So now we've just smeared it out at a much higher, broader scale, but it's excellent. OK, so that's one term. And then there's a second term, because we've got to differentiate here, because there's a time in here. So I'm going to have plus 1 over the square root of dt. And so I'm going to have f prime as a function of its argument. And then I have to differentiate the argument itself. And so that's going to be z, because that's what x over root dt is. But then I've got to differentiate the 1 over square root of t here. And I'm going to get minus 1 over 2t. So that's the left-hand side of the equation. And on the right-hand side, I have d second c by the x squared. So when I do that, I get d. And so when I differentiate, well, then I have 1 over square root of dt. And I differentiate twice with respect to x, and I bring down two factors of this guy here. So I'm going to get 1 over dt, f double prime of argument z. So if we put these things together, first of all, the root dt everywhere cancels. The 2t and the t in the denominator cancels. So t goes away. The d goes away here. And so I'm left with the equation f double prime. And then let me put this on the same side of the equation. I'm going to have plus. So there's a minus. So now I'm bringing this all to the same side of the equation. I have plus z f prime with a 2. So I'll put the 2 over here. Plus f equals 0.
Question.
Yes.
Your d and t cancel out.
Well, the d canceled because I had a d upstairs and a d downstairs.
Right.
This t was canceled because it's a common factor t everywhere in the equation.
Oh, OK.
Yeah.
Then you, same goes for the square root of d.
That's right, because it's common everywhere. So yeah. OK. Anyway, so that's what we get out of this thing. And the thing is that, so what we've done now is we've converted a PDE, which maybe is complicated, to an ODE. And this is actually a very simple ODE, because one can write this as 2f double prime plus zf prime is equal to 0. So even I can integrate this. We'll get 2f prime plus zf is equal to a constant. What is this constant? Well, we know that at the origin, if I start with a particle that's localized at the origin, then the probability distribution function should be symmetric in the argument. So at z equals 0, the first derivative is 0. Therefore, the constant is equal to 0. So this comes by symmetry. So now I have the equation f prime is equal to minus z over 2 f. And if we now integrate this equation, we're going to get that f is equal to e to the minus z squared over 4, which is the good old Gaussian. So that's basically it. We have now solved the diffusion equation by a scaling approach. We've therefore found that this concentration profile is equal to 1 over the square root of dt, e to the minus x squared divided by 4 dt. And the thing is that this I wrote with an equal sign. And as it's written, it's actually not quite right yet, because the one thing we didn't guarantee is that this is normalized. This thing is actually, if I integrate it, is a number of order 1, but actually it gives you a number 2. And so to normalize it, there's 1 over 4 root 4 dt here. So I thought I'd show you this, because it's something you don't see in any textbook. And it's kind of a cool way to solve the diffusion equation with very little work. So this use of scaling to simplify PDEs can really be spectacular. And perhaps the most spectacular example of this is there was a very nice example by Jeffrey Taylor. I don't know if that name has ever cropped up in this course. He was a very famous fluid dynamicist in the 20s to the 40s in England. And in 1946, Life magazine published a picture of the first atomic bomb blast. And so you see the spherical radius, you know, this blast wave going out. And so it showed t equals like 10 to the minus 4, 2 times 10 to the minus 4. And they showed the blast wave, and that showed, you know, just what is the radius as a function of time. And so it was a military secret, top secret. What was the yield of this atomic bomb? And so Jeffrey Taylor took these pictures and kind of did this. You know, there's some complicated differential equation for the propagation of a blast wave in the atmosphere, and kind of did this and waved his hands a little bit and said, aha, the answer is 20 kilotons, which was the right answer. And it was a state secret at the time, and he got a visit from the OSS, which is the forerunner of the US CIA, Office of Secret Service. And how did you find out these military secrets? And he was in deep water, hot shit, for a long time until he convinced them, I was able to figure this out just by the power of thought. And the point is that this scaling approach, as I've shown you here, the same line of reasoning works to actually solve that blast wave problem. And maybe I can show it to you at some other time. Anyway, so any questions with this? Yes?
Should you apply somewhere in the normalization of
the... Oh, yes, yes, yes. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. 4 pi dt. 4 pi dt is the right answer. Thank you. Yes?
This approach only works for some very specific initial conditions?
Actually, it turns out that as long as your initial support of the distribution is compact, eventually you'll go to the scaling form. If the initial distribution is already very localized, that there's a power law tail such a mean displacement of the initial random walker is not finite, then this will fail because you'll introduce a new scale into the problem. But as long as the thing is that there's, you know, then you from a scaling perspective, if the support of the distribution is finite, then in the long time limit, this growing scale x squared dominates, and it's the same as starting with a support which is over a zero range. But if the initial support is infinite, then it always competes with this, and then you don't have single scaling, and you have to then extend this approach to have two different lengths in the problem. Okay. Very good. Okay, so the second thing that I wanted to present is the central limit theorem. And before I start this, I just want to check, is this something that you all have been exposed to before? Central limit theorem?
Yeah.
Okay, so everyone is happy with the central limit theorem? Should I derive it my way, or?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, central limit theorem. I'll go quickly since it seems like that I imagine is kind of old hat. Central limit theorem. So the central limit theorem, let's write it as theorem. And since I'm not a mathematician, my statements are going to be fairly sloppy, but they should be relatively correct. So here is the statement of the theorem, that if x average and x squared average for single step are both less than infinity, that's the only condition you need, that the mean displacement, the mean square displacement in a single step are finite, then, let's write it this way, P of capital X, where X is equal to the summation from 1 to, you know, I equals 1 to capital N of little x I. So I have a bunch of single steps, XI, that are, and I should have also said that XI are so-called IID. Have you seen that abbreviation before? Independent identically distributed random variables. So I have a bunch of independent identically distributed random variables. I add them up. I add up n of them. And I ask, what is the probability distribution of the sum? So if the mean step length and the mean square step length are both finite, then P of x is equal to 1 over the square root of 2 pi n sigma squared e to the minus x minus n x average squared over 2n sigma squared. So that's the statement of the central limit theorem. So let me show it. And again, I'll go quick unless somebody stops me. Pardon me? Not too quick. Okay.
Do you mean for that variance to be outside the square root? Or
sorry. Thank you. Thanks. Okay. So the thing is that let's call P of X the single step distribution. And let's call capital P n of X the distribution after n steps. So the basic starting point to derive anything here is a basic convolution equation that relates the position after n minus 1 steps and n steps. So how do I get to be at position x after the nth step? I had to be at the n minus first step. I had to be somewhere. And then I had to hop from x prime to x in the next step. So here's the equation that's saying that to get to x after the nth step, I had to be at x prime somewhere at the n minus first step, and then take a single step from x prime to x. And since the steps are identical and independently distributed, this little p is the same for every single step. So there's no dependence on n in this guy here. Now, the crucial simplification that I'm just going to skip, unless you tell me not to, is that in real space, this is a form of a convolution. And hopefully you know, and Carl Bender is another expert in this, is that when you have a convolution, you shouldn't work with that, but you should Fourier transform. And so when you Fourier transform, this convolution just turns into an algebraic equation. Pn of k is equal to capital Pn minus 1 of k, little p of k. So I'm going to be, I'd say, I'm being very lazy here. So I don't put a twiddle or a hat or anything over Fourier transform. It should be obvious from the context, because I'll put the argument. So this means Fourier transform. So convolution turns this into product in Fourier space. And so now we can just recurse this formula from n minus 1 to n minus 2. And each time we do that, we'll get an extra factor of p. And so this we get little p of k to the power n. And then I have p0 of k, the Fourier transform of the initial distribution. But if the particle starts at the origin, which is the very simplest initial condition, the Fourier transform of a delta function at the origin is 1. And so we can just forget about that guy. So now, in order to solve this recursion, we need to ask, what is p of k? So p of k is the Fourier transform of the single step distribution. So this is equal to, actually, let me, no, I guess I'll stick it here. So this is going to be the integral of p of x e to the ikx to the power n. And here's now where I'm going to use the initial assumptions here, that the mean and the mean square values of these things are finite. So this I'll write in the following way. So I'll write this as the integral p of x, 1 plus ikx minus k squared x squared over 2, dot, 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 dot. And then the whole thing to the nth power. So the first, and then this is all times dx. So the first term is p of x 1 dx, which is the probability of hopping anywhere in a single step. So since I obviously hop somewhere, the very first term is 1. So I get 1. The next term is ik plus ik. And then I have the integral p of x x dx, which is just the mean displacement in a single step. So that was this, that's this guy. And the second term is minus k squared over 2. And then I have integral x squared p of x dx, which is just the mean square displacement in a single step, x squared. And then I have to raise the whole thing to the nth power. And then what I do to simplify this for the from the perspective of inverting the Fourier transform is I'll write this as, you know, this is 1 plus some correction. The interesting limit that we care about is a limit of long time, or large number of steps, and large distance, where k is small. And so now I'm skipping some mathematical niceties. But what I'm going to do is I write this as 1 plus something small to the nth power is just e to the, well, I don't need to say all this out. I'll just write it as e to the n times logarithm of everything else here. And then what I do is a formula 119 that I mentioned in my book that was incorrect, which is that I then expand the logarithm to lowest order. And so what I'm going to get here then is a proxy equal to e to the n. And then when I expand the logarithm of all this guy, I'm going to get times I k x average minus k squared over 2 x squared average. So that comes by expanding the logarithm of this. That's the first order term. And then there's the minus 1 half this, the whole thing squared, and the lowest order term there is just going to be minus x average squared. So now we've found Pn of k, and to then go back and find Pn of x, so let me maybe put it over here. So Pn of x, well, this is a much nicer blackboard. So this is equal to 1 over 2 pi, the integral over all space dx, and then I have to do e to the minus I kx, e to the n I kx average minus k squared over 2 x squared average minus x average squared. Dk, thank you. Thanks for keeping me honest. Anyways, the point is that what I have in this integral is e to linear in k and e to the quadratic in k. And the way we do these integrals is just completing the square and the exponential. And so I'm not going to do any of that because I'm assuming you know how to do that. And the result of all of this is at the end of the day, you get 1 over the square root of 2 pi and sigma squared times e to the minus x minus n x average L squared, or the square root of, no, not square root, over 2n sigma squared, where in this formula, sigma squared is this thing here. And so that was the central limit theorem. So is this, how old hat is this? This is okay? Okay. So continuing on in this discussion of random walks, the next thing that I guess this is going to be my last topic about just classic random walks, I want to now discuss what happens when the assumptions of the central limit theorem fail. And in particular, I want to talk about the case of walks with a broad distribution of step lengths. So you can imagine some kind of a disordered material or some, you know, funky process, like you could have albatrosses flying over the Pacific Ocean, and sometimes they have to fly 5,000 miles before they ever set down. And you could ask, like, what is the probability distribution of displacements for random walks in which each individual step can be arbitrarily long? And so, as you can well imagine, this is actually a very deep problem, and very beautiful methods have been formulated to attack them. But I want to show you a very simple approach. And I have to admit, I don't know the source of where this approach came from. But it's either Shlomo Alexander or Jean-Philippe Bouchot. But it's a very beautiful way of sort of finessing the problem of an infinite step length in a very beautiful way and exploiting the results of the central limit theorem in a, I would say, very clever way to then derive everything you want to know about walks with a broad step distribution. So let's now talk about broad step length distribution. So to be concrete here, let's suppose that we have a single step distribution, little p of x, which has a broad tail. So it's possible to take steps which are arbitrarily long. And so the case I'll take in particular is the following one, mu x to the minus 1 plus mu with mu greater than 0. And this will be true for x bigger than 1. And it's equal to 0 for x less than 1. So let me just sketch it over here. So our single step distribution looks like this. Here's p of x. It's a function of x. I'm going to put a lower cutoff at 1 because I'm interested in long steps. So I don't want to have some singularity, you know, for small step lengths, because that's kind of irrelevant for my consideration. So I'm going to have some value here. And then it has a power law tail that goes off ad infinitum. So I choose step lengths from this distribution. And I want to ask, what is the mean displacement or mean square displacement after n of these steps? Now, the one condition that I've got to have a normalizable distribution is that this exponent mu is greater than 0. So this thing is for normalizability. Otherwise, the integral is not normalized. Normalizability. So I need that just as a basic physical constraint. And the choice of putting the mu in front here and the way I did it here is just for convenience. It looks a little bit simpler. OK, so by construction then, this distribution may not satisfy the central limit theorem. If mu is less than 1, then x average is equal to infinity. And if mu is less than 2 but larger than 1, then x average is finite. And x squared average is equal to infinity. So in both of these cases, the central limit theorem is, the conditions are violated. And one can ask, well, what happens for a random walk in this case? And finally, for mu greater than 2, then x average and x squared average are finite. And so therefore, the central limit theorem works. But I want to worry about the case when the central limit theorem doesn't work. So let me now present to you an approach to deal with this. And again, this method is completely unrigorous, but I think it provides the best physical understanding of these sorts of anomalous diffusion processes. Let me just ask also, have any of you ever encountered anomalous diffusion processes in any of your background? Some of you. OK, obstacles in the way. So that could be, in fact, the opposite limit, where you have subdiffusive behavior, where the mean square displacement grows slower than linear in T. What we're going to learn from this example is that one can have processes where the mean square displacement grows faster than linear in time. And so the goal here is to understand that in the simplest way possible. So I'm going to do the following trick here. So I'm going to take the exact probability distribution. I'm going to replace it by an effective single-step distribution. And this effective single-step distribution is based on some ideas from extreme value statistics. So let me tell you a little story about extreme value statistics, because it's one of those things that, depending on your perspective, I mean, I'll say for myself, the very first time I ever encountered this problem was when I was a graduate student, and I was studying for my comprehensive exam. And there was a problem in a previous practice exam which said, estimate the energy of the hottest molecule in this room. And it just really grabbed me. I loved that problem, and so I understood it eventually. And so, in fact, everything that's going to follow is based on that question. And since this room is kind of hot and stuffy, we can ask ourselves, how hot is the hottest molecule in this room? Somebody help me. Any takers? Yes.
Molecule.
Let's say the temperature of a single molecule is kT, 40th of an electron volt, 300 degrees Kelvin.
No, I mean like.
Yeah.
Like what's?
How do you define it?
What's that?
Well, define it by say the mean kinetic the kinetic energy of the hottest molecule. So, okay. So how fast is it going, and from that extract the temperature. So how fast is the fastest molecule going? Anybody have any thoughts?
Well, we have a Boltzmann distribution.
What?
We have a Boltzmann distribution.
Okay, Boltzmann distribution. Very good.
We have, so we can find like a, you see CDF for like, how do you say
CDF
it?
CDF
like,
means cumulative distribution.
Yeah. You want to like look at some like E, right? And say like, what's the probability that no molecule in this room has an energy greater than E?
Okay.
That should be. Not, it should be straightforward, but it's going to be really hard.
OK, so you have something in mind like this, that there's some Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution of velocities, right? So OK, or Boltzmann distribution energy. I'm doing velocity distribution. So here's P of, or the speed distribution. So here's P of V. Here's V. And you want to do something, say there's some threshold here such that something happens. Yes?
You want to find the base. The threshold such that that region we're cutting off is about equivalent to 1 over the number of molecules
okay.
in this room.
OK, exactly right, exactly right. So we want to have that this area should be 1 over n. So if this distribution is normalized, the probability of having a velocity is definitely 1, then I want to have there's 1 over n molecules here, so that over an ensemble of n molecules is exactly 1 in this region. So that is the condition for which we can then use to estimate the energy of the hottest molecule in this room. And I invite you to do it in your spare time. But now I want to do it for the problem at hand, which is this random walk problem. So the point is that if you think about simulating this on a computer, then you pick random numbers from this distribution, and after you did like a million steps, there would be some step that was the longest. And because there is a definite longest step in this finite ensemble, the effective distribution that you're seeing is not a power law that goes off to infinity, but it gets cut off somewhere. There's somewhere a cutoff. So this thing, I can view as my effective single step distribution. Once I put in a cutoff, there's everything then, all the conditions of the central limit theorem are then satisfied, because for this distribution, which has a finite cutoff, then there is a finite mean displacement, a finite mean square displacement, and I can apply this central limit theorem to this effective distribution. So let's now estimate x max. And so let's look at the longest step length over an ensemble of n steps. So what I would say here to estimate this thing is I'd like to say that the integral for some x max to infinity of this p of x, which is mu x to the minus 1 plus mu dx, should be equal to 1 over n, just as was told to me. And so I get from this, forgetting constants of order 1, so I'm going to get from this, so here I have x to the minus mu. So this is x max to the minus mu. So from this, I get that x max scales as n to the 1 over mu. So again, if you imagine simulating this thing, if you simulated a walk of a million steps, there would be a longest step that you'd find that was a million to the 1 over mu. If you simulated a billion steps, you'd find an x max with a billion to the 1 over mu. But the main point is that it's a finite length. And given that finite length, I now have a p effective. So I infer from this a p effective, which I'll write in the following way. It's equal to 0 for x less than 1. It's equal to mu x to the minus 1 plus mu for 1 less than x max. And it's equal to 0 for x larger than x max. In fact, this form is not quite kosher because one has to multiply by some constant to make it normalized. But it's a detail that doesn't matter if if this x max here is very large, because the amount that I'm screwing up the normalization by is really tiny. So I'm not going to worry about that. But the point is that once I have this effective step distribution, then I can compute the mean displacement in an ensemble of walks that goes up to n steps. So this is what I mean by the little subscript n here. This means the mean length of a single step over an n step random walk. And so what is this? So this is nothing more than the integral of x, p of x, which is x to the minus 1 plus mu dx. And so this integral goes from 1 to x max. And one more thing which is wrong with this formula is that I wrote an equal sign here. It's really not equal, proportional to. And sometimes I play a little bit fast and loose with the meaning of equal sign, but hopefully it's not going to cause too much of a problem. Anyway, so what does this become then? And again, equal sign, it's fast and loose here because it's proportional to, but let me just write equals. So this integral has several different answers depending on the value of mu. So first of all, if I just do power counting here, this is like x, there's a minus 1 here, so it's x to the minus mu dx. So first point is that if mu is larger than 1, then I'll have an integral which is finite. So let me put here finite. If mu is equal to 1, then I have the integral of x to the minus 1 dx, which is logarithm, and so it goes like log of x max. But x max is n to the 1 over mu. So this is like log of n for mu equals 1. For mu less than 1, this thing diverges. And so it's the integral of x to the minus mu. And so this scales like x max to the 1 minus mu. But x max is this n to the 1 over mu. So this scales like n to the 1 minus mu over mu for mu less than 1. So what we see then is that, in general, the mean step length over a finite ensemble of walks is just getting longer and longer unless mu is bigger than 1. And then from all of this, if I want to now compute, let me call this capital X, mean value of this guy, which is the mean displacement after n steps. So I have now n steps. Each step has a mean length given by this. And so what I'm going to get is I just have to multiply n times little xn. So when I multiply by n, here I'm going to get n to the 1 over mu, for mu less than 1. Here I'm going to get n log n, for mu equals 1. And here I'm going to get n, for mu greater than 1. So what we learn then is that the displacement of an n-step random walk is normal, what we would expect. It's a sum of n independent random variables. So the mean displacement is n times the displacement of a single step, which is a finite number. But when mu is 1 or less, one gets faster than linear growth in n. Notice an interesting feature about this result, which is that here the mean displacement after n steps is n to the 1 over mu. The longest step is also n to the 1 over mu. And so what it's saying here is that in this region, a single step dominates. So if you think about the albatross as trying to fly across the Pacific Ocean, he might get on, you know, he might leave like Patagonia and he flies to an island that's like a mile out to the ocean, and then he just sort of flits around there for a couple of days, and then he takes a 5,000-mile trip to like Tahiti. And so one of his steps after many of these hops is dominated by that one long leg that goes from Patagonia to Tahiti. And so you see that the displacement after n steps is the same as the longest step, and all the other steps are more or less irrelevant. So this same approach can be extended to study not the behavior of the mean displacement, but the mean square displacement. The calculus of all of that is exactly identical, so I don't see the need to repeat that because it's everything step by step just the same. But here I just want to try and emphasize the philosophy behind using this sleazy argument to estimate the displacement of a random walk with this anomalous broad step distribution. Questions with anything? So what is the energy of the hottest molecule in this room? Who's solved the problem yet?
Wait, and why do we say that the area in the tail has to be 1 over n?
Because we'd like to have of the order of one molecule. You know, if we want to say who's the hottest, that means that everybody else is less hot. So we want that the area under the curve from the maximum point to infinity should contain just a single particle of the order of magnitude. One can make this actually a much more precise argument, because you can say that the cumulative distribution is a probability that let me answer your question in a little bit more detail, because one can say actually a lot more about that. So suppose that you have a distribution P of X. It's a probability distribution. And let me call Q of X would be the integral from, say, 0. So suppose it's a probability distribution on 0 to infinity. So I just have some positive variable. So Q of X is the integral from 0 to X, P of X, dx. So this is equal to the probability that the variable is less than or equal to X. And 1 minus Q of X, which is the integral from X to infinity of P of X prime dx prime, is the probability that the variable is less than or equal to X. So if you want to ask, you can do the following thing here. You can say that Q of X to the power n, this is equal to the probability that all variables are less than x. And then if you differentiate this, that's going to be the probability that there's one variable which is exactly equal to x and everybody else is smaller. So n q of x q prime of x is equal to the probability that one variable equals x n minus 1 are less than or equal, are less than x. So, I mean, this is formally the way that you solve these extreme distributions.
So why do you differentiate?
So this was the cumulative distribution. So this thing is the cumulative. It's probably that all variables are less. It's okay. So let me maybe write it another way here. So less than or equal to x. Thanks for the question. So this, my chalk is going to decay to zero before the lecture is over, I'm afraid. Is there an extra box of chalk? Good. Oh, no, there's white inside of here. I'll try and apply less force. So this thing is also, let me write it the same way. This would be equal to the probability that the largest value, ln of x, I'll write it this way, x to infinity. If all the variables are less than x, that means that the largest variable out of n is x or larger. So if I now differentiate this, so in fact it's with a minus sign here, so this is equal to ln of x. So the largest variable is just the derivative of this guy. Okay. So how am I doing in terms of level? Am I assuming too much, too little? Okay. Okay. All right. So, and now, when am I supposed to stop?
11:50.
Okay, very good. Okay. So I want to now turn to a very different subject in random walks, and it's one which is perhaps less familiar to you. And part of the reason that I want to emphasize it is because in many sorts of non-equilibrium processes, the notion of first passage is really important. And so I want to spend some time discussing first passage processes. And someone at the very beginning of the lecture knew the answer that if you live in three dimensions, that what was it? What happened to the bird? Who said the comment in three dimensions? You said it. What happened in three dimensions? Okay. So we're going to learn about that in some detail now. So let's talk about first passage processes. So let me first define what a first passage process is. And the thing is that you kids are probably a little too young to be owning lots of stocks and trading European options. But many examples, that's a natural example of a first passage process. So for example, you have the price of a stock. And you might know that as a function of time, stocks can go up and they can go down. They fluctuate in some random fashion. And if you are a stock trader, there are all kinds of ways of making money by fiddling around with computer buttons where you press send or delete at the right time of the day. And so there's things called options where you have something called a strike price. That if the price of the stock reaches this point, something happens. Some transaction takes place where the stock that you own is either sold to somebody else, or you get some kick of money, or there's something that happens. So a basic question here you might want to ask is, what is the probability that a random fluctuating variable will ever reach the strike price? And if it does reach the strike price, how long do you have to wait to reach the strike price? So these are the basic questions that occur in first passage processes. And in addition to looking at stock prices, one can also think about chemical reaction kinetics. You may have some reactants which are diffusing around. And when two reactants meet, something happens. Or you can have a virus which is going in your body, and that if it is attacked by a T cell, it's killed. And if this T cell misses it, you get sick. And so these first passage processes appear in all kinds of cellular processes inside the body. They appear in financial trading. There's just millions of applications of these first passage processes. And so for the rest of this lecture and most of next lecture, I want to focus attention on some of the basic facts about first passage. So the most important result about first passage is the notion of recurrence and transience. So let me say a little bit about that. So recurrence Actually, maybe I'll put it over here, because I won't rub it out. So the technical term is recurrence and transience. And so here is the statement that, first of all, for random walk or diffusion processes, the only parameter that matters is the spatial dimension of the system. And so the statement of recurrence is that for D less than or equal to 2, a random walk is sure to return to starting point. So if you start with a random walker in one dimension, like if I get smashed and I'm just walking around randomly in front of this classroom, going randomly left and right, and do I ever come back to where I started from? The answer is definitely yes. If I do the same thing in two dimensions, the answer is definitely yes. One thing which is weird about this, though, is that it turns out that it requires an infinite time to reach to come back to myself. So I'll come back to that a little bit later on. But then the point is that for D larger than 2, a random walk may not return. So like if you're a parent and you have kids and then you know they turn 22, they finish college, they leave the house. Well, if they're random walkers finding their way in the world and if they're finding their way in a three-dimensional world, you may have a chance of never seeing them again. Whereas if they're living in a two-dimensional world, then they're sure to come back many times and ask for money and things like that. Okay, so what I want to do for the next while then is to prove these facts and to understand them in a very simple and fundamental way. So how do I show all of this stuff? First of all, let me show it to you by just completely drawing a picture kind of solution before I write anything else down. So here's the drawing a picture kind of solution, which is the following, which is let's imagine looking at a trajectory of a random walk in d-dimensional space. So we start with a random walker here, and he makes some kind of trajectory, whatever it is. So here's my trajectory. So after a time t, this typical displacement is of the order of the square root of dt. Right? Because he's moving, that's a mean RMS displacement, root mean square displacement. So the thing is that because the trajectory is isotropic, this trajectory is filling up a sphere. So I should think of a sphere here, of radius, square root of dt. And so my trajectory is somewhere inside of the sphere. So the point is that the volume of the sphere, is equal to the square root of dt, that's the radius of the sphere, to the number of dimensions of space. So now let's think about a random walker in a very high-dimensional lattice. So roughly speaking, in a very high-dimensional lattice, a random walker is very unlikely to step wherever he was before. Because if you have a very high number of spatial dimensions, I make a step like this. And then in d spatial dimensions, I've got 2d minus 1 directions to go and then not return, and only one out of 2d directions where I do return. So in very high dimensions, the typical step never retraces himself. And so the point is that the number of sites visited is roughly t. And that's a sloppy argument, but it turns out to be asymptotically correct. So therefore, the density of points that I visited, rho is the density, so it's the number of sites I visit, t, divided by dt. And now let me forget about the d, because this is already dimensionally incorrect anyways. So it's t to the d over 2 power, which scales as t to the 1 minus d over 2 power. So what we learn from this is that when d is larger than 2, the density of points goes to 0. Which means that it's very unlikely that a random walker ever steps on his trajectory because the density of points is going to 0. On the other hand, when d is less than 2, the density of points is increasing with time. And if the density of points is increasing with time, it means I'm going to hit every single point many times, because if the density of points visited is diverging, it means I hit every point infinitely often. When d is equal to 2, this, you know, hokey argument is very, doesn't tell you anything, because it says that the density is of the order of 1. And as we're going to see in two dimensions, there's in fact logarithmic corrections, and so one has to be a little bit more careful. And the right answer is in two dimensions, it's the same as being in less than two dimensions. It's everything returns for sure. So that is the sort of picture of the basic facts of transience and recurrence. But what I want to do now is let me derive some of this from basic principles. So there is the basic equation. So first of all, let me call PRT. This will be the probability of being at R at time t. This is the good old probability distribution of a random walk, the Gaussian probability distribution. And let me define another quantity I'll call FRT. And this I'll define as the probability of being at R for the first time at time t. So it's given the letter F because it's meant to denote first passage probability, the probability of coming to a particular point for the very first time and never having coming there before. So the very first time you step off of the plane in Heathrow Airport and you've never been there before, that's your first passage to Heathrow. But if you come the second time, well, that doesn't count because you've already been there before. So it doesn't contribute to this F. What I want to do now is write a basic equation that relates the first passage probability to the occupation probability P. And so let me write down the equation, then explain it. So PRT is equal to. So how can I be at position R at time t? And so let's think about it in the following way. If you go out for a date and you agree you're going to meet your date at a restaurant at 7 o'clock, and so I want to ask, what is the probability of being at the restaurant at 7 o'clock? So the restaurant's at position R, and it's at 7 o'clock. And so how can I do that? Well, if you're a person who's nervous about coming late, you say, well, I'll get there at 6:30, and then I'm sure I'm going to be there on time. So you first arrive at 6:30, but then because you've arrived at 6:30 and your date isn't there yet, then you wander around the block and maybe, you know, walk around for a while, and then you check at 6:45, and maybe at 6:50, and at 6:55. And so the way that one can express this is in the following way, that you make a first passage to the restaurant at some earlier time t prime. But then, once you're at the restaurant, then you leave the restaurant and you have to come back again so that you're sure you're there at 7 o'clock. So it'll be a p0 t minus t prime. So what this says is that to be at position r at time t, I got there at some earlier time, and then I wandered around in a circle in the remaining time and got back there at the appointed time, and I have to integrate over all values t prime. This equation is not quite complete yet, because there's one more thing to this, which is that it is possible, so let me write this delta r0 delta t, that if you started at the restaurant and, you know, you started the experiment and you say, I'm going to meet you at the restaurant at 7 o'clock, but if it's already 7 o'clock and you're at the restaurant already, that's your initial condition. So that you need that as well. So this is the basic convolution equation that relates the first passage probability to the occupation probability. And the nice thing about this equation is that it's expressed in terms of the probability distribution, for which probably you all know very much about, in terms of this thing, which we know probably, I assume, you know nothing about. And what we're going to be able to do now is use Fourier transform techniques to extract all of this from knowing this. Did you have a question?
Yeah, so we're assuming then that the walk is translationally invariant.
Yes, we're assuming all the nice conditions, you know, translation invariant, you know, simple step distribution, et cetera, et cetera. Yes?
And why did you integrate over all t prime?
I'm sorry. I should have integrated from some early, from whatever earlier time up to time t. Thank you very much for that question. So the thing is that if I'm going to meet the date at 7 o'clock, you know, if you're really nervous, you come the day before. I mean, whenever, like as soon as you hang up the phone, you run to the restaurant. So that's zero. And then, you know, if you're late, then you're screwed. So it's got to be some time before you get to the restaurant, and then you do the wandering around until you arrive at the right time.
So this includes all the different early times that you could have come?
Absolutely. Because the thing is that this option, you know, you come at any earlier time. You know, so you make your date, you hang up the phone, you run to the restaurant right away, so that's zero. But anyway, you could have come any time up to the 7 o'clock, and if it's after 7 o'clock, well then this doesn't work anymore, but it's only up to that point. Do you have a question?
Just wondering, why is there OR dependence in F, the first passage function? Because is it not defined at a point? You're passing through the same point.
So this, you're asking about here, this
yes.
S. So the thing is that pictorially, you know, I'm trying to go from here, I start at, say, the origin at some time at zero. So let me write this as R equals zero, T equals zero. I start here. And here's the restaurant. So I've got to get to the restaurant. And so how do I get to the restaurant? I can make a first passage at some earlier time, and then I wander around the restaurant, around the environment until I get back here. And then there's all possible ways of wandering. And so the sum of all the different ways of wandering is effectively like sort of a renormalized propagator from the origin to the restaurant. So I'm going from, so I mean, the thing is that if I really want to be pedantic, which I don't want to be here, I should have said position of being at position r time t, having started at r equals 0, and started at t equals 0. And I hate writing all this other crap here, so I just tend not to write it. I just write it like that. Anything else?
And the delta function?
The delta function is the initial condition, because it could have been that if I was really, you know, like a dork or malevolent, that I could have called my date at the restaurant and said, let's meet at the restaurant at 7 o'clock, and I could have called her at 7 o'clock, and it could have been at the restaurant at that time. So that's the delta function. You could have happened to start right at the right place at the right time. OK.
The delta function, normalization-wise, is 1 that equals 0. When you write it as a delta function, I assume that's not infinity.
Well, the thing is that there's a delta function, there's a continuous delta function at t, because I'm actually here. There's a little bit of, I mean, this is formally correct, and maybe not explaining it quite kosher, but the point is that I'm doing a discrete space, continuous time, no, actually, yeah, continuous time, discrete space formulation. So I'm never really at t equals 0, because I'm never at, you know, this always like, I'm not sure I know how to say this right, but it's just that this is the initial condition that I started at the origin at the restaurant. I think that's all I have to say.
Usually delta 0 continuous is infinite, right? So
that's right.
Still the case here.
Yes, absolutely. So this is the good old Dirac delta function. This is the Kronecker delta function.
And we're not integrating over it or anything like that.
Well, we'll see in just a second what's going to happen.
We don't mind that this.
No, we need it. Or else we. Okay, anyways, well, how do we solve this? So the thing is that whenever you're dealing in with translationally invariant processes, whenever you see a convolution, it should cry out to you. And if it doesn't cry out to you yet, you know, like hit yourself over the head and say, you know, it should cry out to me, Fourier transform or Laplace transform, do some sort of transform to get rid of the convolution. So here the appropriate thing is to do a Laplace transform. So I'm not going to, you know, if you want to see the details, maybe we can do it in the afternoon, but I'm just going to skip over and just say, let's go to Laplace space. So now the index little s here is meant to represent the Laplace transform variable. And so let me just maybe define it over here, because
why Laplace instead of Fourier?
Because first of all, it's over a positive s. Like if this went from minus infinity up to t, then I do Fourier transform. But because it's a one-sided problem, I should do Laplace transform. So let me just sort of maybe put a little box over here. F of s is defined to be the integral of f of t e to the minus st dt from 0 to infinity. So go to a Laplace transform. And the thing is that when you Laplace transform this equation, magically, convolution turns into product. And so what we're going to get here is F R S P 0 S. And when I look for Laplace transform the delta function, well, that just gives me 1. And so I get plus delta R comma 0. So in particular, we now have a equation that tells us what is the Laplace transform of the first passage probability. So F R S is equal to P R S minus delta R 0 divided by P 0 S. And moreover, we're typically interested in the problem of first passage to the origin. So we imagine starting with a random walker at the origin and asking what is the probability he returns to the origin. So F 0 S, the first passage, the first return to the origin probability. So this cancels, gives me 1. And then this delta function becomes 1. I get 1 minus P 0 S. So this is the basic equation that I'm going to spend the rest of this lecture analyzing. And so again, with the right perspective, a complex convolution problem is now transformed into a really trivial algebraic equation. The trick is that you probably aren't used to living in Laplace space. And so you might ask, well, what is this heck is this P0S? And hopefully I'm going to demystify it in the next 10 minutes. And then we will have answers for this first passage probability. So now let's figure out what this is. So let's first of all look at P0t. So for the good old random walk problem, we know that this is asymptotically 1 over the square root of 4 pi dt to the power d over 2. Right? That's, you know, there's times Gaussian. But if we're interested at the origin, it's just this power law. And so for the rest of this discussion, I'm just going to say it's t to the minus d over 2. So I just don't worry about 4 pi's and d's or anything like that. And you can restore them as you want. So well, let's now calculate the Laplace transform, P0s. And you see that because there's a dimension of space that appears here, it should not be a surprise that the dimension of space will appear in the Laplace transform. And it appears in a very fundamental way where 2 becomes really special. So let's try and estimate this thing. So let's write this. So this is equal to the integral from, well, in principle, it should be 0. But thing is that this formula for the occupation probability of a random walk, this is already based on a continuum approximation of a discrete random walk process. And there's nothing that blows up at t equals 0. There's no blowing up of the probability distribution, because I started with, say, a discrete random walk, and then I took the t goes to infinity limit, and I got the Gaussian. So this form is not appropriate to apply t going to 0. So to compute the Laplace transform, I should put a lower limit here, which is not 0. So I'm going to put nothing here to denote that the lower limit is definitely not 0. So the exact form for the probability distribution is not a Gaussian as t goes to 0. So that's why I just will say, well, I could put some lower cutoff epsilon, like I guess you call it infrared cutoff. Or I could put a lower cutoff 1. It doesn't matter. But there's just some lower cutoff here that I won't bother writing. Integral from 0 to infinity. And then I'm going to write t to the minus d over 2 e to the minus st dt. So that's the definition of the Laplace transform modulo this little sleazy trick over here. Now again, your first lecture today, Carl Bender is truly a world's expert in mathematical physics. And what I'm doing now, he would probably kick me in the behind for being sleazy. But the thing is, if you just want to be correct, get the right answer, then you know, it's like one of those old adages that mathematicians want to prove the truth and physicists are content just to know the truth. So I'd like to show you the truth and someone else can prove it. Anyway, so how do we do this integral? And it turns out that, again, it's very different what happens for d less than 2 and d larger than 2. And when d is less than 2, it's actually easier than when d is larger than 2. So notice that when d is less than 2, this thing blows up. Right? When d is less than 2, we're integrating something which is very singular, which has a very long tail, and so the integral blows up. But we're cutting it off with this exponential. So I can do the following very sleazy trick. So let me maybe represent it over here. Here's my integrand. So here's a function of t. So we have, you know, t to the minus d over 2. And then we have this exponential function like that. So that here's e to the minus st. And it cuts this, it obviously cuts off the integral exponentially quickly. And clearly, this is a finite integral for any finite value of s. So what I'm going to do, in the spirit of being sleazy, is say, well, look, this is a sharp cutoff. The cutoff is of the order of when t is 1 over s, it's cut off. Let's just do that. Very drastic approximation. And it turns out that this drastic approximation, when the integrand diverges, gives you the correct asymptotic behavior. It does not give you the correct prefactors, but it gives you the right scaling dependence on time. And that's all I want to get from this argument. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, I'm going to replace this. So the lower limit is undefined. The upper limit is 1 over s t to the minus d over 2 dt. So this sleazy argument, which is admittedly extremely sleazy, but also works, is going to be appropriate whenever the integrand, this infinite integrand, diverges. So this will only work for d less than or equal to 2. For d larger than 2, something else happens that I'm going to have to worry about later on down the road. So I'm being very slow here because I'm like waving my hands. Well, I'm not waving my hands, but figuratively, I'm waving my hands fairly vigorously because I'm doing some steps which are not easy to justify by any mathematical proof perspective, but they contain the truth of the matter. And so now, even I can do this integral. So this integral is of the order of t to the 1 minus d over 2, and evaluated at 1 over s. And so I'm going to get this scales like s to the d over 2 minus 1. And this is true only for d less than 2. So notice here I said d less than or equal to 2, it worked. Question, yes?
Can you explain why you chose 1 over s?
Because my true cutoff was this e to the minus st. And if you ask yourself, what does an exponential function do? So when t is small, then you know this exponential is close to 1. When t is of the order of 1 over s, then it's e to the minus 1, and that's sort of the characteristic scale, which it's fallen off by 1 over e, and then it falls off like 1 over e squared at 2t, and at twice the characteristic scale. So when t is 1 over s, it's giving you an idea of where the shoulder is in the exponential. So I'm saying replace a smooth shoulder just by a sharp shoulder. That's all. Anyways, so for d less than or equal to 2, the integral diverged. But the thing is that when d is equal to 2, I have to be a little bit more careful. Because when d is equal to 2, then I have t to the minus 1 dt. And the integral of 1 over t is log t. And so I'm going to get log of 1 over s for d equals 2. For d larger than 2, well, I get a finite number. That's all I can say. So finite. Well, what am I trying to say here? Finite, yeah, finite. For d larger than 2. Let's see if I get to the punchline by 11:50. I should be able to do it. OK, so now let's calculate f, the first passage probability. Of 0s. And so let me write it explicitly for like d equals 1, 2, 3. Yeah,
please.
Yeah, but the lower limit, we said we don't put a 0 here because there's an infrared cutoff. So that's a fake divergence that doesn't exist in this problem. OK, anyways, f0s. So I have to take 1 minus this. So I have a little bit of problem with doing trivial algebra here. So this is, for d equals 1, it's s to the minus 1 half. So I take 1 minus this. So I'm going to get 1 minus the square root of s for d equals 1. And again, there's a number here, a coefficient that we can calculate, but I'm not bothering calculating it here. And you can't get it by this very sleazy approach. Then here, I'm going to get 1 minus, so it's plus 1 over log s. And here I'm going to get a finite number, so finite. So this is d equals 2, d equals 3. So, you know, you may realize that what I'm doing here is what you probably encountered in many kinds of mathematical physics problems, that you start with some complicated integral or differential equation, you Fourier or Laplace transform it. In the Laplace domain, it's easy to solve. You solve it, and now I've got to do the inverse Laplace transform of this. And so, again, I have no idea like how comfortable you feel with doing Laplace transforms and its inverse. But what I want to show you again is that by a series of tricks of the same degree of difficulty mathematically, one can inverse this transform with essentially doing nothing. And so let me start on that route. So let's first of all just focus attention on d equals 1, because it's the simplest case and perhaps the most relevant case. So let me just note the following fact, that let me call t of t, let me define this to be the tracking probability. So I can imagine now that if I get smashed and I'm random walking around in this room, I can put somewhere and drill a hole in the floor that goes down 100 feet. And if I fall into the hole, I die. And I can ask, what's the probability I'm still alive up to some time t? So what this capital T of little t is the probability that I've been killed up to time t. So this is nothing more than the integral from 0 up to t of f of t prime dt prime.
Where is the hole for t of t?
Well, I mean, for this formalism, I should have put it at the origin. And then I'm asking the problem of returning. You know, I start at the origin, and as soon as I step away, then the hole is drilled. And then I'm asking, what's the probability to come back to the origin and fall down the hole? OK. Anyways, then there's a complementary thing, s of t, which I can write as a survival probability. So that's not the probability that I'm not trapped. OK. But the thing about this guy is that what is this object here? By sleazy trick number one, where I said that, where did it go? Somewhere over here. Notice that a time integral over a finite range was like a Laplace transform. So I'm going to do the same thing here. This is essentially the Laplace transform. This is nothing more than the f of s, the Laplace transform of the trapping probability evaluated at 1 over t. So again, I've done something very profound in a very sleazy way, and that's why I'm sort of stopping every time I come to it. You know, the right definition of the Laplace transform, I have to integrate f of t prime dt prime e to the minus st prime. I'm going to remove the e to the minus st, changing the slow exponential cutoff to a sharp shoulder, and that's why there's an upper limit t. And so this is nothing more than the Laplace transform. So the point here is that notice that we found the Laplace transform of the first passage probability from here, but the Laplace transform we can relate to the trapping probability, and from the trapping probability we're going to get back to the first passage probability. I think what I'm going to do now is I'm going to wait for that punchline for next time. And so tomorrow I'll begin right here, and I'll work through and calculate the first passage probability, and then that'll serve as a nice starting point for doing some important basic facts about first passage and calculations of things like first passage times, which appear in all kinds of physical applications. So is this okay, time to stop now? Okay. So I'll stop for questions, and otherwise, lunch, I guess. What? Yeah, I mean, all of this, you know, here, like d, you can think of as a continuous variable, and all that matters was d less than 2 or bigger than 2 or equal to 2.
Very strict bound, like d plus, like 2 plus f. Because, I mean, we did a lot of this wavy math here, so how strict is this? Do you have a bound already?
Oh, no, this is definitely true. Yeah.
So you get the weird stuff?
So one of my friends.
Yeah.